large, lively and spirited gathering called together here in Adelaide on a cold winter night to hear about history. But I guess we're not really surprised. It's been interesting to see the way in which there is such a good response. You know, the Festival of Ideas and various public lectures conducted by the three universities and so on seem to attract audiences. You've just got to have the right topic and the right speaker, and people come along and hear it. It's a sort of old-fashioned thing to do, but it's coming back into fashion, and it's marvellous that it is, because public discourse is so important in whatever topic. As you know, this is the annual lecture of the History Council of South Australia. We see this as our peak event, if you like. We do a lot of things behind the scenes. We're an umbrella organisation for those who are not familiar with the council. We have affiliated members from a range of groups. They include government departments. Indeed, History SA itself, the History Council of South Australia, is a member, and its director, Margaret Anderson, is on our council, I'm pleased to say. But apart from those government agencies interested or involved with history, we also have a range of community and local history societies and other groups, all with this common cause. They're diverse, their activities permeate in all aspects of the community, but they're fired up by their passion in history, heritage, our past, and what it stands for. And also, of course, where an understanding of our past may lead us into the future. And that's the most exciting aspect of history, I think, for all of us. So the History Council sees itself as a non-government means of collecting all these groups and interests together, aiding and abetting the promotion of history, acting as an overall lobby group, helping to harness the resources that are not ours, because we're a purely voluntary amateur body, but are out there in the community. I think our most recent and spectacular involvement has been in the battle for the National Archives Office, which so many of you participated in one way or another. It's yielded success, or what I call a stage one success. We're now working on the stage two. But I tell you, that's looking very prospective and interesting as well. And there will be some announcements made about that down the track. And in that, the History Council was pleased to be part of the group and at times able to spearhead or gain access for crucial lobbying activities in the course of that. So there's a lot of stuff we're doing like that in and around and behind the scenes. But in terms of a public face, we do see something like the annual public lecture or the forum that we put on in the same room in the History Week as being part of our role and function as well. In fact, from its foundation, the History Council has had its annual lecture. This is, in fact, the seventh. That's how long we've been in operation. We've had some marvellously distinguished speakers, Stuart McIntyre, Jill Rowe, Susan McGarry, Eric Richards, Henry Reynolds, Bob Carr, and tonight, of course, Angela Woollacott. So it's been a pretty diverse group, all with very interesting perspectives. Some of those addresses have been published. They're available on our website. And incidentally, in speaking of our website, I'm sorry to say it's inoperative at the moment. Our service provider, gave us about 2 weeks' notice to say that we're deregistering a number of sites. We're not going to be servicing them anymore, and yours is one of them. You better find somebody else. We're on the quest at the moment. We hope it will be up and running very soon indeed. It has to be, because our annual general meeting is in the first week of September. However, it hasn't impeded our publicity and promotion of this lecture, thank goodness. And one of the main reasons it hasn't, of course, is that the State Library of South Australia has very generously provided its support and backing, assistance with the venue, assistance with the bookings. We're also lucky that our secretary Annette Mills is an employee of the library. I'm sure that she only does History Council work in her own time, but nonetheless, she does a great job from that base, which is marvellous. So I'd really, Alan Smith was going to be here tonight. Unfortunately, he's taken unexpectedly ill. So he apologises, but I would like to, on all our behalf, thank him very much for the way in which he makes the library available, promotes and encourages these sorts of activities. So a great partner to have. And the History Teachers Association of South Australia has also been an active supporter of these lectures over the years, which again is marvellous. They're a tremendous group of huge enthusiasts, and their day has come, their moment has arrived. The National History Curriculum is at last placing history centrally into the schooling from every year of the students of Australia, an appreciation of theirs, of the world's, of the past histories. And we, as a History Council, have been monitoring and making representations around the National History Curriculum as it's been developed. One of our members is involved with the National Curriculum, but the History Teachers has certainly spearheaded this, and History Teachers are going to be very, very important in the future. Unfortunately, you look at our History Teachers and they're a somewhat graying bunch. There's a gap there, and there's some massive education and training that's needed, and I think our history departments and other areas are beginning to respond to that and feel the demand, which is another exciting thing about the future for history. Just on housekeeping matters, after Angela has given her address, there will be a bit of time for questions or comments from the floor. Then we repair to the next room for refreshments. It's just around the corner to the right. You'll have somebody to direct you there, so I hope you've got a bit of time to stay there. We have to be out of this building soon after 7:30, or we start paying overtime. Alan's very generous, but he's not that generous. So bear that in mind, but I'm sure we'll have time to mix and talk and reflect in our refreshments. So please join us for that. A final thing I'd mention, on your seats you will find postcards. Wolf Press, Rob Foster and others have been actively organising this little project. Part of the idea of these postcards is to publicise the History Council and its contacts and activities, but most importantly, it's a way of seeking suggestions on our 175th. It's languishing a bit at the moment. We need to spark some enthusiasm and energy about it. It's languishing in large part, I have to say, because the government basically just hasn't really been fired up or shown a great deal of interest in it, despite the best endeavours of a number of groups and indeed History South Australia itself, which is beavering away, but in a pretty difficult environment. And certainly with no special funding at this stage. However, we haven't given up, and we'd like you to think of some ideas, and if you've got them, write them down. If you're absolutely inspired tonight, there's a green box as you come into the lecture room here. If you could drop your postcard in there, but if you need more reflection about it, please post them in. I assure you they won't be ignored. They'll be part of the grist to the mill as we prepare a major lobbying exercise over the next couple of months in relation to what we're going to do in 2011 to mark 175 years of European settlement in the province of South Australia. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's now my pleasure to introduce our lecturer tonight, Professor Angela Woollacott. She's come to us today from Canberra, where she's the her role is as Manning Clark Professor of History in the School of History at the ANU. In a way, she's back to her origins because she did her first undergraduate BA degree at the ANU. And then she had a real flash of inspiration and energy and came to Adelaide to do her honours degree. Such was the activity and energy of history that other ideas like law and so on were abandoned by Angela at that point. She focused in on the pursuit and enthusiasm for history. gained her honours here, worked in the Constitutional Museum, that much regretted departure from our museum offerings in this state, as greedy members of Parliament sought to take over the premises that a pioneering and remarkable museum had established itself in. Be that as may, that's old history, I'm not going to revisit that there. Angela, after that, has gone on to a stellar academic career as an historian, culminating in her doctorate in the University of California, Santa Barbara, where she worked for some years, gaining a number of academic distinctions. Coming back to Australia immediately prior to her role in ANU, she was Professor of Modern History at Macquarie University, and establishing for herself a niche and expertise in history that has been very significant indeed. Her specialisation revolves around Australian history, British Empire history, women's and gender history. And she has got a constant scheme of projects and publications on the go. Her most recent single author book, was Gender and Empire, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2006. But there's a string of other publications, both single and edited in conjunction by Angela, review articles and so on. She's certainly an eminent academic, but she's also a great communicator. And we're fortunate tonight to have her sharing with us the fruits of her latest research and her ongoing project in this area, with a particular focus on South Australia. And that South Australian connection, serendipitous as it may be, because it wasn't for that we sought Angela out as the lecturer, will, I think, give an added perspective to her address and her appreciation of where South Australia fits in to this broader study, which in fact embraces international questions. So, without more ado, I'd like to introduce our seventh distinguished annual lecturer, Professor Angela Woollacott.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction, and I would like very much to thank the History Council of South Australia, and in particular Dr. John Banner, for the invitation to come and give this evening's lecture. And as a proud South Australian, it gives me a great pleasure to be here. I also just want to point out that my credentials as an Adelaidean include having attended Unley High School, a credential recently made famous by someone else from Canberra. My paper tonight is drawn from a larger study, which has been generously funded by the Australian Research Council. The project reconsiders the decades from the 1820s to the 1860s, a foundational period in Australian history, arguably, I would make the argument, at least as important as Federation. In these decades, convict transportation was brought to a staggered end, first in New South Wales and last in Western Australia. The numbers of free settlers rose dramatically, surging from the 1820s and again during the 1850s gold rushes. Most colonies achieved responsible government, a radical shift from penal settlements to self-governing societies. Yet there is much that is little understood about how inhabitants of the Australian colonies perceived the growth of a free settler society from its convict origins, how Australians, as they started to call themselves, understood their rapidly evolving place in a profoundly changing world. The core of my study is the rapid expansion of settler society in Australia in these crucial decades, when the British population shifted from unfree to free. Settler colonies dramatically expanded their territorial claims, even though viewed in terms of the whole continent, they remained small. And both settlers and colonial officials had grand plans for colonial possibilities. In order to understand contemporary perceptions of the colonies taking shape, I want to consider settlers' and residents' knowledge of and reactions to specific events around the British Empire, reactions to frontier conflicts in other colonies, and commentary on wars elsewhere. The larger project will also consider gendered conceptions of the free settler and ideas about what it meant to be a free white settler in an empire based on racial hierarchies. My interest in gender includes the conception of political manhood, the cultural process by which men were endowed with political authority and the right to vote, and women excluded from it. Settlers' placing of the maturing Australian colonies in imperial and global context casts light on what the transition to self-government in Australia meant both to them and to others. What I want to do tonight is to look at a few aspects of the ways in which South Australian settlers saw themselves in wider imperial context, to suggest a little of what that broader perspective can tell us. Of course, South Australia was a key colonial experiment of the 1830s, a successful implementation of Wakefield's systematic colonisation. South Australians knew that they were not the only participants in that particular experiment and took pride in their own relative success. They learned about the later systematic colonies in New Zealand, also based on Wakefieldian principles, including from 1839 the settlement in the Wellington area, and later those at Whanganui, New Plymouth, Nelson, Otago, and Canterbury. They also knew about the less successful version of Wakefield's idea, the settlement of Australand in Western Australia. Australand was established in 1840 by the Western Australian Company, just north of Port Leschenault or Bunbury. The very name of Australand was significant. It was called Australand to signify its location on the Australian coast, but in a situation that would foster a relationship between Australia and India. Australand, the name in fact being a contraction of Australia and India, would represent the possibilities of trade and exchange between the two colonies of the British Empire. Just like South Australia, Australand was founded on the careful plans and schemes of a group of men in London. Maps were drawn up, plans made for a supposedly ideal town, a prospectus drawn up, and much effort put into advertising the colony. The company's prospectus showed the town as they intended it to be laid out, with formal streets, public squares, wharves, marketplaces, even colleges, a hospital, a theatre, a town hall, and 6 churches. 100-acre farms were sold in London, ahead of the settlement being established. As in South Australia, the proceeds of land sales were to be used to pay for the passages of labourers, as well as improvements to the town. The settlers who sailed were thus a mix of the more affluent elite of the colony and those intended to do the labour. It was a community that would have clear class lines, as well as developing racial divisions, including the employment of both Aboriginal workers and some labourers brought from India. Australand survived, despite setbacks and defectors, and is today a dormitory suburb of Bunbury. But it did not fulfil its founders' dreams, and as an example of systematic colonisation, was always overshadowed by South Australia. South Australians' knowledge of and curiosity went well beyond the other systematic colonies. On the 23rd of August 1851, writing from Adelaide to relatives in England, Caroline Clark revealed the detailed knowledge settlers in the Australian colonies had of sea routes, cargoes, ports and vessels, including the place of, quote, the East Indies, unquote, in the imperial mercantile economy. Quote, your letter came by a direct ship from England, and it is best to send by first ship direct from Plymouth, unless you know something of the vessels that are about to sail. Letters come to us by way of the East Indies, for many that come here with a cargo go there to obtain a cargo for home again. Latterly, Liverpool vessels have come far more quickly than any others, but it is not always the case that they carry mails. Newspaper intelligence is generally 10 weeks in advance of information by letter, so it is clear enough that our letters are much longer on their route than they need be. End quote. Caroline and Frances Clark had arrived only the year prior, in June 1850, with most of their 8 surviving children and a servant, hoping for a healthier, more prosperous, and of course religiously freer life than they had led in Birmingham. In March 1867, Caroline was still obsessed with ships and the mail. Quote, The incoming of the English mail is the one event in the month that we colonists all regard with great interest, and its approach is signalled by the hoisting of a checkered flag, and also by the raising of a ball in town. We can see the flag and ball with a telescope from our garden, and we can see the smoke of the steamer as it passes along near the coast for 4 or 5 miles of its voyage." End quote. Mail to and from England was settlers' source of contact and information with the world beyond the Australian colonies. Ships carrying mail and newspapers were their lifeline to relatives and friends, and their conduit of knowledge about economic, political, cultural, social, and diplomatic affairs. But the knowledge brought and carried by ships extended beyond England. This imperial network had links in many directions, and the contact settlers so desired was to many points. Settlers and residents in the Australian colonies had personal connections to and knowledge of many places around a rapidly globalising world. Voyages to and from Australia involved calling at ports in Africa, the Indian Ocean, Asia, and South America. Many settlers in the eastern colonies and some in South Australia had themselves served in the British Army in India. Sick soldiers and pensioners from India commonly sojourned in the Australian colonies and stayed. Settler families had members whose service in the British Army, ambitions or trading interests, had propelled them around the world. Letters brought news from Calcutta, Cuba, or Hong Kong. Flourishing colonial newspapers reprinted news from India, Canada, New Zealand, and elsewhere. Australian colonial newspapers assumed their readers were interested in a wide range of news items. On the 24th of September 1832, for instance, the Sydney Herald's East India News section included items about the danger of tigers around Singapore, calls for a law court in the Straits Settlements, a list of trades and occupations carried on by, quote, Europeans and Indo-Britons, end quote, in Calcutta, the price fetched by New Zealand flax in Ceylon, and a report of an uprising by Parsis in Bombay. Such news items reveal both particular interest in other British colonies in the Asia-Pacific region and a wider curiosity about the world. We're beginning to learn about the nature and extent of colonial traffic between Australia and India, thanks to research such as Margaret Allen's work on Indian men in Australia and Australian missionaries in India, and Joyce Westrup and Peggy Holroyd's book on, as they title it, the, quote, surprising history of connections between India and Australia, end quote. Some South Australian settlers had direct experience of India, such as Captain Charles Bagot, whose prior military career included South America, the Cape of Good Hope, Mauritius, and India. I want tonight to touch on a few of the ways in which South Australian settlers knew about connections between the Australian colonies and India, their awareness of trade with India, and of the importation of Indian labourers, as well as how closely they followed events in India, not least the events that became known as, quote, the Indian Mutiny, unquote, of 1857-58, a rebellion that threatened British control in India, and thus was a real moment to British settlers in the Indian Ocean region. Turning firstly, then, to trade with India. In 1870, Adelaide settlers Nora Burney Young and her mother, Lady Charlotte Bacon, were much preoccupied with the possibilities and pitfalls of trading with India and Ceylon through the ill-fated business enterprise of their brother and son, Anthony, also known as Harley. In April 1870, Lady Charlotte wrote, quote, "Anthony has gone to Ceylon. He sailed on the 19th with 52 horses, most of them his own, cows, flour, potatoes, and fruit. If he arrives with his cargo safe, I hope he will make a good thing of it," end quote. Nora, however, gave her sister in England a much less sanguine account of the same undertaking, quote, "Harley has gone to India with horses. I'm sure I hope he will succeed, but I feel much fear because somehow he always makes a mistake in everything he undertakes and he's lost so much money. It must be acknowledged that Harley is not clever, and he has no head for business transactions." Mama is in very good spirits just now. I think she anticipates a certain success with regard to the horses, but I'm afraid she will be disappointed, end quote. In July, Nora wrote to her sister, now concerned that her brother's folly may have implicated the new governor, Sir James Ferguson, who had arrived the year before. Quote, we have heard from Harley, and I'm afraid he's not done very well. He says he has made enough to pay expenses only. So I hope and trust Sir James will not be let in. His kindness was beyond that of even a brother. But I quite tremble, for although Harley means well and would intend to repay, he is so weak and foolish that he is led into all sorts of extravagances, and all his money goes in rioting in the town. If the governor knew it, I'm sure he would be very vexed, for he is so particular, and Harley does not even riot in a gentlemanlike way, but goes about with such a low set. Pray don't mention this, burn my letter. People see Mama's weak points, and to please her, they praise Harley, and she believes it all. And a man who was a known liar told her the other day that nothing could have exceeded the manner in which he transacted his business in Ceylon. The energy and knowledge of business he showed was surprising. And dear Mama tells this to everybody, and I feel so sorry to hear her, because I know people smile at it afterwards, for Harley has no notion of business. End quote. By September, Nora's anxiety was focused on whether and how much of the governor's money Harley had lost in his failed trade speculation. Quote, I have not been able to find out from Mama whether Harley was able to return all Sir James' money. She will not say a word except that he did himself very little good. I want so much to know that she is so touchy about him, I dare not say anything. If he has lost any of the money and I knew it, I would never show my face at Government House again. I think with such advantages, he might have done better, but you know Harley is not clever. End quote. So if Nora was worried about her own social acceptability at Government House, Sir James's involvement in the speculation was not based on ignorance of colonial mercantile relations. In fact, he had served in London as Under Secretary for India from 1866 to 1867. And I can add that Harley's undertaking was only one instance of wider trading connections between India and the Australian colonies. So my second focus is knowledge of Indian indentured labourers in the Australian colonies. On 8th of September 1838, the South Australian Gazette and Colonial Register reported on the, quote, importation of Indian labourers, end quote. Refusing to engage in a prolonged discussion of the issue, the paper limited itself to commenting on evidence from the coroner's inquest, quote, on the body of a Hill coolie, end quote. The paper thought its readers would agree it was, quote, quite clear that these poor men ought to have some protection from the misconduct, neglect, or cupidity of their masters, and would share its pleasure in stating that His Excellency, the acting governor, has promptly determined to make formal communications on the subject to the Colonial Office and to the Indian government, end quote. The unfortunate Indian worker, whose death prompted this discussion, was one of the group brought by settler Joseph Bruce from Calcutta when he took up a land grant in South Australia in 1838. But the issue of labourers from Asia did not go away. In May 1847, the South Australian Register ran a longer piece commenting on proposals in South Australia for the importation of labourers from China, comparing them to plans in New South Wales for importing labourers from Polynesia. The paper argued that, rather than bringing in, quote, coolie labour, unquote, the colony's government should spend money on assisting destitute labourers in the United Kingdom to emigrate, because British labourers, quote, would form a permanent addition to our numbers and would mix without tainting our population, end quote. Yet, Asian labour was not out of the question. Our fields must be tilled, the Register continued, quote, our flocks must be watched, our mines must be wrought, and if the labour needed for these purposes and for which we have paid is not furnished to us, we are fully justified in adopting whatever means are at our disposal in order to procure an adequate supply, end quote. Westropp and Holroyd contended in 1848 Indian shepherds were employed in the northern reaches of South Australia. Another historian, Richard Broom, has shown that while in South Australia from 1836, Aboriginal people worked as servants, messengers, seamen, blacksmiths, and gatherers of wood and water, in southern New South Wales in the Port Phillip district from 1830, they worked in similar capacities, as well as clearing ground, ferrying sheep across rivers, as native police troopers and guides, in fishing, sealing, whaling, and gardening, and in the pastoral industry as shepherds, stockmen, bullock drivers, and in sheep washing. Similarly, in documenting and paying tribute to the Aboriginal people who worked as, quote, stock workers, shepherds, trackers, troopers, pearl divers, or servants, end quote, across the Australian frontier, Henry Reynolds contends that they, quote, were in a very real sense Australia's black pioneers, end quote. Indeed, evidence of the employment of Aboriginal servants and labourers crops up in records from a range of colonial sites. Mrs. Alice Hughes wrote in her memoir of her 1840s childhood in the town of Wellington in South Australia about, quote, a black lubra who did washing for us, end quote, and other Aboriginal people who, quote, would do a little work for tea or sugar or a stick of tobacco, end quote. Mrs. J. Fairfax Conagrave, who arrived with her parents in 1853 and whose father purchased land on Hindmarsh Island, recalled, quote, Papa used to employ a number of Aborigines at harvest time, as the wheat had to be reaped with a sickle. The consequence was we often had a whole tribe of blacks with their lubras and piccaninnies camped a few hundred yards below our house. Some of the women made excellent servants, and we became very attached to them. We had a washerwoman who was a really fine character, end quote. Across the Australian colonies in the first half of the 19th century, in addition to the employment of Aboriginal workers, various indentured labour schemes brought Indian and Chinese workers. Apart from the Indians who arrived as convicts, from 1816 onwards, groups of labourers were brought from India under indenture. Instances included the 14 servants taken to Port Phillip in 1843, the 25 domestic workers, including women and children, taken to Sydney in 1844, and the 50, including men, women, and children, who arrived in Sydney in 1846. Indentured labour schemes that brought Indian workers to Australia may have been more common in New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, and Western Australia, including, I should point out, some at Australand, that I just mentioned. But we know that there were several in South Australia, both from the newspaper reports I just cited and other sources too. The memoir of Eliza Seremani, for example, provides evidence of both Aboriginal and Indian labour. Marnie, whose family arrived in Adelaide from Ireland in 1839, recalled of her parents' farm north of Adelaide in the Gawler area, quote, "The blacks we were very much afraid of at first, though they were very quiet. There were about 250 in the Para tribe. We tried to get them to work for us and to wear clothes. After a time, they did some work for us, but would never wear the clothes we gave them," end quote. A little later in the memoir, she notes, quote, "While in Adelaide, a picturesque sight I remember was the camp under the fine trees in the parklands of Mr. Gleeson, an Irish gentleman who had just come from India with his rupees, Arab horses, and Indian servants. He afterwards lived at Clare," end quote. So I think what I find particularly interesting here is that the employment of Aboriginal people by settlers has often been studied in a separate historiographical frame from work done on the employment of indentured labourers, the importation of indentured labourers. I think when we put both forms of non-white labour together, we can see them at the same time, and we can see how widespread it was in these decades of rapid settler expansion. So my final substantive topic is the South Australian press coverage of the quote-unquote Indian Mutiny, which is perhaps better called the War of 1857 to 58. In May of 1857, Indian soldiers at Meerut near Delhi mutinied, killing their officers and all the other Britons they could find. They set fire to their cantonment and then marched to Delhi to proclaim the Mughal ruler the head of Hindustan or India. When word spread, similar uprisings occurred by sepoys, as Indian soldiers were called, in other parts of northern India. The rebellion was a protest against British presence and rule in India, and was largely sparked by the way that the British were running their army. While problems in the army were the specific cause of unrest, it was fueled by deep resentment about British power, British intervention, and British economic and political control in India. In short, resentment against British imperialism. It took the British 2 years to completely quash the uprising and the ensuing rebellions. In those 2 years, the British fought hard to regain control, even though the spate of rebellions was in one particular area of northern India. A number of peasants rebelled in support of the sepoys, and in the cities of Delhi and Lucknow, support for the uprising was such that there was extensive fighting and destruction. On the 2nd of August 1858, the British Parliament passed the Government of India Act, transferring all the rights the East India Company had previously enjoyed in India to the Crown, that is, to Queen Victoria and the British government. A cabinet-level position was created, the Secretary of State for India. Perhaps the most pervasive impact of the war was in the increasingly bitter and tense race relations that would characterise the British Raj for the rest of its existence. On both sides, memories and stories of the acts of violence during 1857 and 58 were constantly replayed. On the British side, exaggerated stories circulated from the beginning, so that events like the killings at Kanpur, which was called Cawnpore, then, were told in highly melodramatic and untrue ways that exaggerated the numbers dead and the way they were treated. Not least, stories of sexual assault by Indian men on British women became central to these accounts. Memoirs, fiction, and plays were produced by the British for the rest of the 19th century. We can track interest in the so-called mutiny through its coverage in the South Australian Register. In the 1840s, the Register's interest in India extended to occasional articles on political and military events. In 1857, the frequency and extent of the coverage escalated dramatically. The Register printed stories arriving from Calcutta newspapers, the Lahore Chronicle, Singapore newspapers, the Friend of India, and the Bombay Telegraph. By July 1857, the Register editorialised on the crisis, considering that although the, quote, disaffection appears to be more widespread than was at first imagined, end quote, the likely outcome would mostly consist of punishments of the Indian troops involved, which it hoped would not be too extremely severe, a merciful attitude that later evaporated. In September 1857, its tone had shifted. The Indian troops involved were now called, quote, the monsters engaged in the recent inhuman butcheries, end quote. Yet the paper pointed to the vast size of the British colonies in India, the small proportion of Englishmen compared to Indians, and corruption in British administration. Quote, the extension of our Indian frontier, like the extension of our African frontier, has involved the British Empire in accumulated expenses, and has rendered the administration of its colonial government infinitely more difficult than before, end quote, the paper opined. But by October, the Register's tone was irate, quote, it may indeed be useless to dwell upon these horrors, but is it right to dismiss from our minds the consideration of the unutterable sufferings of our fellow subjects? Ought we not, even in these remote dependencies of the British Crown, to evince some measure of sympathy with the unhappy victims of this most fiendish rebellion? Had the sepoys merely united to exterminate the European population, brutal as it would have been to murder inoffensive women and children, our feelings of indignation would have been less intense than they now are. But to practice every conceivable refinement of slow torture upon shrinking women and harmless babes is so utterly inhuman that its perpetrators have no claim to any other treatment than would be awarded to wolves and tigers, end quote. The paper continued with a lurid account of the violence at Kanpur or Cawnpore, with highly detailed stories of extreme violence supposedly conducted by sepoys on British children and the rape and mutilation of British women. before pointing out that, quote, a great degree of uncertainty characterizes all the accounts received from India, end quote. By July 1858, the paper openly displayed racial and religious bias, alleging that even the most horrific stories from India gained credibility from, quote, our knowledge of Asiatic cruelty, end quote, and the way power is, quote, wielded by depraved idolaters and essential disciples of Muhammad, end quote. Perhaps the best evidence of the extent to which South Australians cared about events in India are the poems penned by Caroline Carlton, who arrived in Adelaide in 1839 with her husband Charles, who had served as ship's surgeon on their vessel, the Prince Regent. Caroline Carlton undertook projects such as setting up schools, but what she's famous for is being the author of the lyrics of the Song of Australia. Most of us know the first verse of that song, written for an 1859 competition run by the Gawler Institute, starting with the lines, quote, there is a land where summer skies are gleaming with a thousand eyes. I'm sure many of you could sing that. End quote. Though few would know the words of all five verses. Even fewer among us, I suspect, would know that her patriotic and pro-imperial poems included at least two poems about the Indian Mutiny. One, titled The Cawnpore Massacre, includes the lines, quote, the music of the sunlit wave with its crest of rainbow light sounds like the footfalls of the past on memory's tablet bright. This saddened heart can only hear in the music of the sea a wailing from a far-off land, a dirge-like melody. To fancy's ear, the murmuring waves echo a funeral strain and chant a requiem for the souls of the Cawnpore victims slain. The freshening winds fan the glad brow. Sweet is the evening breeze that gently stirs the pensile leaves of the silvery wattle trees. But a taint of blood is on the blast. A death shriek fills the ear, a tortured mother's bitter cry of agonized despair. End quote. In February of 1858, an Indian relief fund was set up in South Australia at the request of the governor. Carlton wrote another poem, simply titled Lines, in support of the appeal of the Committee of the Indian Relief Fund to the Australian colonies. Its first stanzas ran, quote, though we must tread the circling earth till half its space be traversed o'er, before our longing eyes can greet the white cliff of Britannia's shore, and though beneath Australian skies our children pluck the clustering vine, with throbbing hearts we proudly own, Britain, our fealty is thine. And when the quivering needle points to woe and danger threatening thee, the answering chord responsive owns the electric touch of sympathy, end quote. I'll spare you the rest. But I think these lines and Carlton's desire to help the Indian Relief Fund speak to the connection that at least some South Australians felt the imperial effort to put down the uprising in India. Imperial troops were dispatched from the Australian colonies to fight in India. Some press reports reveal a feeling of vulnerability when the British troops stationed here left. More amorphously, the threat to the British Raj implicitly unsettled the stability and prospects of the British colonies in Australia. So I think that these press reports that I've read to you from the South Australian Register tell us several things about Australians' perception of their relationship to India. And I should point out I've read comparable articles in both Sydney and Melbourne papers, and they're very similar. And I think what they tell us about Australians' perception about their relationship to India and their position in the world includes the fact that the reports are written from a stance of imperial unity and identity. They all say we, our, and us. They also point to the significance of Australians identifying as Christian versus Muslims and Hindus. But they also show a sense of involvement, of wanting to defend the interests of the British Empire. And finally, I would point to the way they show the supposed horrors perpetrated on British women, and how those recounted horrors show ideas of both gender and race shaped by stories of Indian insurrection. The War of 1857 to 58 in India was far from the only imperial event that the South Australian Register covered. The paper had earlier covered the so-called Kaffir Wars in South Africa in the 1840s and early 1850s, with unambiguous bias against both the indigenous Africans and the Dutch Afrikaners. In 1846, as well as later in 1860, the Register followed in detail the wars in New Zealand, frequently expressing great respect and sympathy, really notable sympathy, for Maori, while of course ultimately supporting both British right and British might. Even beyond economic matters of trade and labour, South Australians, I think these reports show, were keenly interested in the world around them. They followed news and events via both their newspapers and personal letters. We can reconstruct their sense of themselves as participating in the wider project of British imperialism, a shared enterprise in which British colonizers and settlers supported each other through trade, the sharing of troops, charitable relief, religious commonality, moral support, and racial solidarity. Settlers here viewed the Australian colonies as dependent on British success elsewhere, even as they sought in these decades to gain greater autonomy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Angela. You've certainly traversed a wide field and drawn together a number of quite different strands in that presentation. We've now got some time for questions or comments, so I open it up to the floor. Must be first.
The direct importation of Afghans to South Australia in the 1860s, are you including that as a direct form of trade in people as well as other things?
Yes, that's a very good point. It's so interesting. It actually comes just after, I'm stopping in the 1860s, and the importation of the people who were called Afghans, but who in fact came from a range of northern parts of India, northwest India, the area we now call Pakistan, into Afghanistan. It started, I think, from the 1860s onwards, but it became such a significant phenomenon in terms of economic matters, trade, transport, of course, northern South Australia and across the centre of Australia. So yes, I think that's a very important subsequent development to the schemes of indentured labour that I mentioned.
I've got a question myself. I was interested in your passing reference to what seemed to be an apparent lack of sympathy of any kind for the Kaffir and other foreigners of the wrong hue in various parts of the empire, but a sympathy to Maori. Mm-hmm. Why was this so, and how was it expressed?
Yes, it's such an intriguing question, and it comes up repeatedly because it's something that was not just Australians, but other members of British people and members of the British Empire gave evidence of feeling. It's a really interesting question. I'm not sure how well I understand it from the reports that I've read. It seems to be that from the reports in the Register specifically, it seemed to me that one aspect was the feeling that the Treaty of Waitangi should have meant something. So I think there may actually have been a feeling that South Australia had been founded on certain principles, and that the Treaty of Waitangi had established certain principles in New Zealand in the early 1840s, and that the treatment of Maori subsequent to that had somehow negated the Treaty of Waitangi. So I think there was a feeling of historical injustice, but at the same time, I think there was also a kind of respect for the way Maori fought, that there was this feeling that Maori were particularly strong warriors, and there have been many scholars that worked on that. The New Zealand historian James Bellett, for example, has done a lot of work on the Maori Wars, and the fortifications that they put up, which were particularly impressive.
Right.
Angela, much of what you've been talking about is about the dynamics of a labour market. That is to say, the local society is looking for workers in various ways. To some extent, I'm reacting a little bit in the context of the present election campaign, where journalists are criticising certain politicians for focusing on migration control when they really should be talking about the labour market. That's my general point. But in that context, I'm wondering whether, while you're right to talk about the connections, the interest in these tiny flows from India, for example, of people, relative to, for example, the very large flow of Welsh and Cornish miners and so on, we need to keep perspective. And we need to recognise the colony, I would have thought, was able to attract and select for all sorts of different reasons. And of course, there's just a large, what Eric Richards calls the diaspora, of British coming out of Britain, some of whom coming to South Australia. So, you know, there's a sense of scale and a focus on labour rather than on race relations that I'm wondering about.
Well, yes, absolutely. You're right to point to the focus on labour. I think we do also have to look at the issues of race relations that I've been trying to suggest. I think you're quite right that when we look particularly at South Australia, or look only at South Australia, the numbers of Indian and Chinese labourers brought here were quite small. I suppose we have to add that during the gold rush, after the Victorians added particular tax on ships arriving, a whole lot of Chinese actually walked across part of South Australia. But they were small when we look at the numbers, and you're quite right that really the preference was for labourers from Britain, and I think that piece I read from the Register pointed to the fact that they really would have preferred that. But what I found interesting about it was, well, of course, you know, that's what we ought to be doing, but if we're not getting the labourers we need, we're not ruling out trying to get labourers from Asia. So part of what I find interesting is that this continuing debate and this sense that we're not going to rule that out. We're going to continue to have that as a backup plan. But I guess I've been focusing on South Australia tonight, but in my larger study I'm looking across the continent, and what I find striking is when you look across the continent in these decades and you piece together small scheme of indentured labour and small scheme of indentured labour and you add the numbers up and you see it stretched across the continent, and then when what I have been trying to suggest, if you also add in at the same time the extent of employment of Aboriginal labour, it becomes a cumulative picture in which it's no longer insignificant. I think it's something that we need to recognise is happening in these decades, and that the debate was occurring in these decades. And we all know that we didn't become a plantation economy. Even in Queensland, the numbers were limited and the Polynesians were excluded. But I guess because I'm trying to see reconstruct these decades, I think we need to see it, the significance of it then.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. A most informative lecture. I wonder if I could be permitted to add a little bit more about Lady Charlotte Bacon.
Oh, please do.
Because her mother was Lady Oxford, who was Lord Byron's lover.
Yes.
And she came as Lady Charlotte Bacon to Australia, to South Australia in particular, because her three children were living here, one in Walkerville and one on Fullerton Road in the 1860s. And she brought with her the coach that Byron had bequeathed to her, a horse-drawn coach, as it happens. And this coach was sold on when she went back to England 6 or 10 years later. Was sold to a farmer from the Eyre Peninsula and was found behind the Lake Wangaree Hotel in 1918 in the Chook House. Totally preserved with the Byron emblem on the side, etc.
Wow.
I have a photograph of this coach that was in the Australia Day procession in Port Lincoln in 1918 with Black Fanny, the last Aboriginal woman of that tribe, sitting in the coach.
Wow.
And then it was sold off piece by piece, and there are people in Adelaide that still have pieces of that coach. And the son, Harley, was actually involved in providor, if you like, for Charles Todd's telegraph men working with the provision of supplies in the form of sheep and cattle for their food, etc. But it's interesting to note that his father, that is Major Anthony Bacon, was in jail with Robert Goodger in the debtor's prison, the same as the debtor's prison we've just seen in Little Dorrit, for a short period when they talked about the potential in South Australia. So, and of course the father who fought on the in the Peninsula Wars was in jail because of his horse trading at the time. So I just thought it out.
Thank you, that's wonderful. I knew about the Byron Connection. I didn't know about the coach, which is fabulous.
Well, and I just gave a paper in Keswick in the UK to an English literature group on Byron's barouche and the outback Aussie chookhouse.
Thank you for that. That's
great. Yes, Julie.
Yeah, this is such an interesting question that we keep coming back to in Australian history, and I think it is a very significant question. I mean, clearly, in the early years of South Australia, this was such an important point of distinction that South Australia didn't have the convicts. Yet we also know that many former convicts, emancipated convicts, and ticket of leave men came over. So that, in fact, you know, before too long, there were quite a few of them here. You know, the attitude, I suppose, I mean, in a way, it was a bit more of an abstract discussion here in South Australia, whereas in the eastern colonies, it was so real. And one of the things that actually I mean to do as I keep working on this project is I want to try to think through what was happening in these decades when, you know, I want to piece together the indentured labour schemes and the employment of Aboriginal labour that was so widespread, but to really think through the fact that it was that was happening in the same decades that convict labour was still so widespread, because it was in the 1830s, 40s, into the 50s, convict labour was still so significant in so many parts of Australia, and I want to try to make connections between those different forms of labour, because for one thing, when you put them all together, you end up with a really significant system of unfree labour of the three different kinds that are overlapping and intersecting in these decades. So I think, I mean, in a way, that is one big difference with South Australia, that you don't have that kind of unfree labour here when it is happening. And, you know, with Western Australia starting off with no convicts, but then going to convicts and turning Aboriginal people into convicts on Rottnest Island and then forcing them into labour gangs. So I continue to be intrigued by this. As much as convicts seem like a part of Australian history that we've done, you know, that we've worked on, I continue to find it really interesting to put into this picture.
Yes.
Professor Woolnocott, I'm just interested in the issue of the price of labour in the period you've been describing. Were people concerned about the relative cost of, indentured labour and convict labour versus labour of free settlers? And was that a matter of concern?
Well, one of the appeals of indentured labour was that it was cheaper than free labour, you know, unregulated labour. You know, indentured labour contracts kept the wages down. So it was definitely one of the reasons that people kept looking to indentured labour schemes in this period. And certainly the price of labour was very important, and as you may know, in the first couple of decades of South Australia, there were real economic swings. There were times of real economic difficulty and trouble and depression, and you know, when you read settlers' accounts in these years, you know, they're just explicit about suddenly there's this terrible economic downturn, we can't sell anything, there's no, you know, can't get a job, no labour being demanded. And then South Australia gets hit by the gold rush when so many people leave, go to the eastern colonies. So you know, these economic matters are very serious, and the price of labour is a real issue. So it was part of the appeal.
I'm just interested in whether you found opposition to the use of indentured labour because of its effect on the cost of labour.
Well, certainly it was one of there's very much a debate about indentured labour and a lot of opposition to it, and that is definitely one of the points that's constantly made against indentured labour, as well as the treatment of the workers. So there's, you know, this debate that goes through these decades about, you know, indentured labour and anti-indentured labour. definitely the cheaper cost of indentured labour, and what would happen if that was, you know, if the scale of indentured labour became greater, what would happen? But you know, in the eastern colonies, there was a lot of fear about what would happen when the convict system was finally over, and that form of cheap labour disappeared. So that's another part of it.
All right. Well, I think we're all about ready for questions. Thanks for fielding those questions, Angela. We've certainly, I think tonight, had a glimpse of that kind of circularity of history that often occurs. All those connections and developments, and in South Australia, of course, a particular relevance that went on well into the 1890s was the use of indentured labour for the development of the Northern Territory. And you've got even, you know, a staunch white Australian like old Tom Playford speculating on a trip to India in the 1890s about what benefits Tamil labourers, who he's particularly impressed with, would provide in doing something about unlocking the Northern Territory. And then, of course, the white Australia policy put all those connections on hold, finished off the relationship. And yet here we are in 2010 with this burgeoning relationship with India, one of the growing economies, with thousands of Indian students in our midst, and the odd Indian taxi driver in the cabs and so on, and a quite different relationship, but really strong. It's almost as if time was interrupted for a while, and now it's being resumed, but on a different and better basis. And of course, I'm surprised we can get through any sort of discussion about the connections between India and Australia without mentioning the great shared passion we have for cricket, which will ensure that we are bound together in all sorts of ways well into the future. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Angela, for that lecture. We hope we'll be able to... We've recorded it so it can be podcast and accessible, and I would hope that, you know, we can disseminate much more widely beyond this audience tonight, because there's a great deal of interest in this area. Now it just falls to me to thank you very much indeed for coming along, and there is some wine, some food, some refreshments and some good conversation next door. Please join us for the next half hour or so. Thank you very much.